Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. We want to get right to a story on this Friday that demands our attention, the escalating humanitarian crisis in Iraq, where the United States military has now conducted its first airstrikes on ISIS forces and artillery. In recent weeks, militants with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, that's ISIS, have taken Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. ISIS stormed across the north of Iraq and are now threatening to take the Kurdish capital of Erbil. They've also seized control of the Mosul Dam. That's a strategic and crucial supply point of water and electricity for most of the populated parts of Iraq to the south. Senior Obama administration officials last night called the ISIS assault highly efficient and sophisticated. But in the midst of the attacks, thousands of Yazidis have fled in fear of ISIS. The members of the Kurdish religious minority group are being terrorized by ISIS, and they fled up a nearby mountain called Sinjar. In a moment, we'll talk more about the decision by President Obama to order humanitarian airdrops and authorize airstrikes. But take a moment first to listen to one woman directly affected by this crisis. Julie Khalaf is a 28-year-old Yazidi refugee living now in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's the largest Yazidi community in the U.S. She came to the United States with her family in 1998 after fleeing two wars in Iraq and nearly a decade of life in a Syrian refugee camp. Many of Julie's relatives and the relatives of those in the Lincoln community are among the 40,000 Yazidis trapped atop the peaks in Sinjar, or similarly captive in the ISIS-held towns below the mountain.
There is at least 700 Yazidis here in Lincoln, and what we're hearing is that ISIS has taken over Sinjar district. That's where most of the Yazidi sect live. About 200,000 of them have fled to the mountains on the outskirts of Sinjar, and the rest are left behind. Those who have fled are not safe because we are in contact with the people, and they're saying they don't have any basic necessities. There is no water. There is no food. And we're getting a lot of calls saying we just buried. Excuse me for a second.
That's quite all right.
Saying that I just buried my two-year-old because I didn't have enough water.
You received, someone you know received that call?
Yes, here in Lincoln.
Well, the situation is certainly dire. Are you hearing about any ability of Kurdish Peshmerga to provide some sort of defense for people who are stuck in the mountains or elsewhere?
For the past month, there were 5,000 Peshmergas, that is the Kurdish security forces. They were in Sinjar, there to protect them. But as soon as the ISIS, the Islamic extremist group, showed up, all of a sudden, there was no Peshmergas left. There is nobody helping them. The 5,000 just left within like 2 hours. They had cleared up the Sinjar district, and there's nobody who's helping them. Let me emphasize the earlier points. We have gotten a report of people who have fled to the mountain. At least 70 kids have died out of thirst, dehydration, intense heat, and 50 elderlies have died also. The rest who are still left behind in Sinjar are basically stuck in there with ISIS roaming the streets, and their women are being taken. Some are raped, some are killed right away, and there's instances of women's circumcisions and their women taken and sold by the extremist Islamic group to other people. Everyone is just watching. No one is going for their rescue.
Can you describe a little bit your own path to the United States? You were in a refugee camp for a large part of your childhood. What drove you there, and what was that experience like?
In the 1990s, my parents fled Iraq because of endless wars. First, there was the Iran-Iraq war, and after 8 years of it, Saddam Hussein turned against the Kurds, which means Yazidi too, and just gassed and tried to massacre many of them. He wiped out a whole town that was filled with Kurds. That means Yazidis also. Then there was the Gulf War in 1990s, and that's when my family had a chance to flee Iraq. At that time, I was 4 years old. We came to the refugee camps in Syria. The situation there, it was terrible conditions. It's the camps we were living in for 9 years were basically same as the camps you take for camping. That's what we lived in for 9 years during winters and during summers. We were living on small rations of food. Our bread and that was given to us had bugs in it. The water that was delivered to us was with tanks, and it was very unsanitary. One tank would be for at least 50 families, and a lot of times as we were trying to get to the water, fights would break out because there was just not enough of it. In schools, we were treated as second class. We were forced to read Quran, and if we did not read it and participate in it, we basically would fail our classes. During holidays, none of our holidays were recognized. We would watch and see the other people from other religion get gifts and presents during Christmas and Ramadan, but we would not get any of it, and we were just basically not treated well at all.
Julie, what are your fears for the next couple of days here as we hear about the terrible plight of the Yazidis isolated there in the mountains of Kurdistan?
I am really scared, first of all, for my own families, and since my parents, their immediate family is stuck there. My dad has taken ill to bed. We have not heard from my uncle and aunts. My sister-in-law has basically been breaking down in tears for the past few days. There's been many sleepless nights for all of us. Some of my friends have tried to commit suicide because of just the sense of feeling helpless. A lot of us are not even participating in school or in our jobs because we just cannot focus. We cannot focus on anything else.
Is your community there in Lincoln holding together, Julie?
We are gathering just to at least for the company of each other. And we have done few rallies here in Lincoln trying to bring the awareness to this atrocity, this situation. At this time right now, a group of Yazidis have gone to Washington to plead to the Obama administration for immediate help. And we fear that if no one intervenes soon, it's going to be too late. The raping and the kidnapping and the circumcision cannot be undone. And I'm scared that it would affect my family, and if it affects my mother and my father and my sister-in-law, I'm just scared of what will happen to us.
Julie Khalaf spoke with us just hours before President Obama ordered limited American intervention in the crisis. She's a Yazidi refugee currently living in Lincoln, Nebraska. Mother Nature is throwing a 1-2 combination at Hawaii this week. Two major storms. The first is Hurricane Isel, was just downgraded to a tropical storm, actually, but it hit the island with high winds and major rainfall. And now Hawaii's preparing for a second storm, Hurricane Julio. Now, hurricanes are rare in Hawaii. It's been 22 years since they had one, and before that, not since 1871. Let's talk now to Hawaii Public Radio's Bill Dorman. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Todd.
Well, how are people preparing down there? How's it going?
Going with aloha. So far, so good in some ways. On the Big Island of Hawaii, we had some torrential rain, some heavy winds. As you mentioned, hurricanes taking a direct hit on the islands is something that's very unusual. But in terms of high winds, heavy rains, that's something that people actually are quite used to. The tropical storms glance by, but we certainly have them in the neighborhood pretty often. And so high winds and heavy rains are something that people are somewhat used to dealing with. It's a matter of degree and intensity. There are tropical storms that do come through here, heavy seasonal rains with gusty winds, but hurricane strength winds, as you mentioned, that's another matter.
Well, it was heartening that Hurricane Isel, as I said, was downgraded. Julio has not been. So what are the latest forecasts for how severe this could be?
Well, it's a matter of tracking them in terms of direction. It looks like Julio at this point may bounce a bit north of the islands, which would be a welcome respite for that. But the back-to-back nature is also very unusual, something we don't have. in addition to everything else going on, we have some elections coming up. We have the state primaries coming up on Saturday. Right now, in terms of forecasters, as they look at this combination of tropical storms and Hurricane Julio, it looks like the elections may slip in right in between the storm systems. Although it was interesting, a couple of lawmakers sent out tweets late on Thursday asking people to take their campaign signs down from their lawns. It may be the first time that politicians are asking to have campaign signs removed.
Those things could turn out to be a lot more dangerous than usual. It's actually no joke if they start flying in the wind.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that also in terms of everything from beach furniture to lawn chairs, things like that, people pulling those inside, and resorts and hotels. That's another thing that makes Hawaii different in terms of these storm systems. About 200,000 tourists are on the different islands of Hawaii each day, and that's in addition to a population of about 1.4 million. So that adds another level to some of the preparations here.
200,000 tourists there now, Bill Dorman, but what about people due to come to the island this week? That's major money, major economy for Hawaii. Are people canceling their trips, their vacations?
Well, it's high season, and I think it's more at this point a matter of delays in a lot of cases than it is outright cancellations because, again, don't forget these storms move pretty quickly. Once they come through, then that's it. I mean, the approach has been for several days looking at this, but while we've been talking about the approach and the hurricanes coming, under Oahu, we've had sunny skies and very nice weather for most of this week. So it's really a matter of timing on the storms and timing on people's travel as well.
Is there any sense of, before we let you go, Bill Dorman, people's confidence in first responders? These are rare events, so maybe some of the first responders or disaster relief organizations might not be very tested.
Disaster relief, first responder folks here have had a very good track record in what they have done. A lot of times when emergencies are anticipated or bad weather is expected and things don't turn out as badly as they might have, still the responders and the preparation teams have been ready. That's been the case with tsunamis, tsunami warnings, things that have not turned out to be tremendously damaging, also tropical storms in the past. But again, I think there's a pretty high degree of confidence in that group of folks here and a lot of aloha for their work.
No doubt about it. Well, Hawaii is preparing and apparently preparing pretty well, we hope, for two storms headed their way. Bill Dorman of Hawaii Public Radio. Stay safe, Bill.
Aloha, Todd.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Well, it's weekend time, and that's movie time here on The Takeaway. It's time for your movie date with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hey, Todd. Hey, Todd.
Of course, Rafer and Kristen co-host the Movie Date podcast, and you can subscribe to the Movie Date podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Well, this week we're going to talk about a summer storm thriller called Into the Storm. It's an adaptation of the multicultural, also, sorry, Into the Storm is not an adaptation of a gastro romance novel, no. But the 100-Foot Journey is, and the heroes in the half shell are back in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We have to talk about that also. Now, let's start with a little bit of trivia, because I know you guys love some trivia this week. We're going to be talking about Into the Storm, as I mentioned. Now, one of the stars, one of the co-stars of Into the Storm is Matt Walsh. Now, a lot of people know his face, but they don't know his name. So tell me, in which popular TV show does Matt Walsh play a hapless guy who just wants to sail on his boat? Don't answer. Hold your answer, and we're going to ask it again at the end to see if you know. All right, guys? Now, let's start with Into the Storm. How about a clip here?
I'm not going to risk it. I've got hundreds of scared people.
You will have hundreds of dead people if you stay here.
Sir, I study storms all my life, all right? And this one is bigger than any storm that has ever been. Can you hear that? It will flatten this building in seconds.
Exactly. With or without you, we're getting these people onto those buses right now.
Oh, Kristen Meinzer, we are getting these people under those buses right now.
Maybe you shouldn't. No. You know, I just think it's really unfortunate this movie had to come out a few days after Sharknado 2. So many of us are already, you know, we're still on the high of having sharks and chainsaws flying through the air at us. And this is just like, there's like one fire NATO. There's kind of a half plane NATO, but most of them are just kind of regular tornadoes. So I thought that was unfortunate. The tornadoes themselves look great, but the rest of the movie surrounding the tornadoes made me a little too dizzy. Lots of handheld camera, lots of flimsy characters, and a lot of buildup before we actually get real storm scenes.
Rafer, did Sharknado steal the storm's thunder here?
Yeah, I have to say it's kind of surprising at this late date that people are still making movies this bad. It's really extraordinarily bad, this film. And, you know, as Kristen was saying, it's one of these found footage mock documentary. So there's always some dude sticking his face in the camera saying, "Are you guys seeing this?" And then when it's all over, someone will run up and say, "Did you guys see that?" It's one of those movies. I think the clip there, you know, really says it all.
Blair Witch meets the tornado. It's the Witchnado.
Yes, exactly.
It's Into the Storm. I think we've got it here. Well, let's switch gears drastically now. The 100-Foot Journey, a gastro romance novel adaptation, which I mentioned. Here's a clip.
This is flavor that is fighting against the chicken.
I added some spices for flavor.
Did sauce and coriander for garnish and freshness.
But why change a recipe that is 200 years old?
Because, madam, maybe 200 years is long enough.
Rafer, we're listening to Helen Mirren there amongst a cast of, I guess, a lot of actors from India.
Yeah.
How does this work? You know, sometimes when you see a film that is cast as a European or white person amongst natives, it can get very stilted and kind of weird.
Well, this is one of those movies, as you can hear, Helen Mirren there is feeding lines to Manish Dayal, who plays an Indian chef. And she's, you know, asking him, but why change this recipe? And that is so he can bring his homespun wisdom to Helen Mirren, the snooty French chef.
Yes.
This is a Lasse Hallström movie. He directed Chocolat. He did Once Around. He did Cider House Rules. He's a really good director, and he really knows how to make well-crafted schlock, and that is what this is. It's fun. The acting is great. It's a nice, pleasant storyline. It's about as reality-based as a Shakespeare comedy, I would say. It all wraps up wonderfully at the end. No spoilers there, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's not much to it, but it's enjoyable, and it's very well-made.
Kristen, deliciousness on the screen?
I agree with Rafer. It's kind of a food porn movie. It's the south of France. It's beautiful people. I have to say, Manish Dayal, who's in that scene there with Helen Mirren, he's just gorgeous to look at. I could just watch him all day. He's beautiful. And, you know, it's pleasant. There's nothing really that's going to surprise you. Nothing really bad happens. It's just a really pleasant situation.
All right. Well, now, the moment you've been waiting for. Let's spend a minute, if we must, with Megan Fox, Johnny Knoxville, and others in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Hey, Mikey, remember that thing you used to say when we were kids?
You made me promise never to say it again.
Forget about that. Still got one in the tank.
I've been holding it in for years.
Wait, guys, we need to...
Cowabunga!
Cowabunga. Kristen Meinzer, tell me you loved it.
You're smiling as if I could possibly even love it as a joke, but no, I can't love this movie. It was so terrible. The tone was off. The first half was overly serious. There are weird jokes about how hot Megan Fox is coming from these turtle humanoids that just kind of creeped me out in that Howard the Duck sort of way that
well,
makes
they are
me
teenagers.
Cringe. Yeah, but they're turtles.
Mm-hmm.
They're giant turtles walking around, and I feel like they just never quite got the tone right of how they were going to treat these turtles.
Rafer, a lot of people have fond memories of the Mutant Ninja Turtles as kids. They were super popular. We loved them. Does it work?
You know, yeah, the cowabunga line there is a famous Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles line. You know, I think if you're a fan, you might like this a little better than the 1990 original movie, which has gone down as kind of a notorious dud. But I would say it's harmless junk. You know, it's produced by Michael Bay, who did the Transformers. It looks and feels like a Transformers movie. It's junky. It's dopey. I don't think it's very funny, but I didn't think it was awful either.
Well, if you can tolerate it, come for the Michael Bay, stay for the Wiz Khalifa. I'm told by the control room, in fact, there's a Wiz Khalifa track in this movie. So
I did not know that.
Well, now you know. Well, since you did not know that trivia, I have some additional trivia for you guys. Now, we had some trivia from Into the Storm at the top of the segment here. One of the co-stars I mentioned of Into the Storm is Matt Walsh. A lot of people know his face, but not his name when they hear it. So tell me, which popular TV show does Matt Walsh, in which does he play a hapless guy who just wants to sail on his boat, Kristen?
I am stumped, and I know that you tried to stump me, and you usually do, so
you
won this
week.
Of course
you are. You're stumped. Rafer?
Is it Veep?
It is.
I also wanted to show you the second most important person on the Veep's team, beside myself.
The coffee machine.
You know what? Three more of these and I'll be ready for the day.
There's Matt Walsh starring as Mike McClintock, the press secretary communications director for the Veep herself. Rafer, good job.
Thank you.
Kristen, I'm sorry. We didn't expect much more from you. You did get it last week. But once again, we've restarted our streak. That is one. Flip the card. Number of times Kristen's been stumped in a row. We're back to one. Thanks, guys. Kristen Meiser, takeaway culture producer, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. The Movie Date culture team, download their podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
You're listening there to a video that's been viewed over 95 million times on YouTube. It's the Korean girl group 2NE1. You get it? 2NE1? They're kind of the Spice Girls of South Korea. And they're performing a kind of music known as K-pop. That's electronic beats, futuristic visuals, bizarre but mesmerizing outfits. But these bubblegum pop songs are more than a musical genre. They're part of a Korean cultural takeover. Behind those poppy vocals is a lot of strategy. Korea has been planning its cultural dominance for nearly two decades since a debt crisis hit the Asian continent in 1997. It's been no accident. The economic meltdown devastated a Korean economy too dependent on huge companies like Hyundai and Samsung, and it forced them to find a way to diversify and do it fast. Yuni Hong is the author of The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. And she says that in those dark days of debt, Korea actually hatched an intentional plan to make themselves cool, cool in the eyes of investors and an international audience.
Literally, there is nothing that money can't buy. There are a couple of reasons why Korea pulled this off. One, the government is heavily, heavily invested in the project of making Korea cool. They hired Edelman PR, with one of the biggest PR firms in the world, and said, we need a new spin to our country. Another is that their model, if you look at the things that are popular, K-pop, for example, they groom them the way that Romania grooms gymnasts. They pluck them at age 12. They start them in training. They're not even permitted to perform publicly for maybe 5 or 7 years. And what's really crucial is not just that they start rehearsing at a young age, but they start rehearsing as a group at a young age so that they look and sound in sync. And that has become the hallmark of the K-pop video. As for other aspects of Korean cool, we have the dramas, which are very popular, strangely enough, because I think I call it the Twilight effect. After Stephenie Meyer's Twilight, the world realized that there was actually a need and a want for sort of chaste romantic dramas, and that's actually what the Korean drama provides.
So give us a couple of other examples then of Korean cool.
Well, I think that what's going to come on the horizon is the fashion, particularly the male fashion. I'm not sure this is going to take off in the U.S. because we have a very binary idea of what constitutes male clothes and what constitutes female clothes. And the K-pop look is kind of androgynous. And I would compare it to David Bowie or Elton John.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, we're going to see some Ziggy Stardust comebacks.
Now you're talking. Sign me up. I would like it if everybody walked around like the Thin White Duke. I'm there. Is this what Korea has to offer coming up?
Yes, it does. And I think Psy, I mean, he did wonderful PR for Korea, but like a lot of people, I kind of wince when he comes up because that's not what I think of when I think of Korea. The things that are really coming out of Korea are very slick, very streamlined, well-designed, architectural, just everything, just very high quality.
And now there's one aspect of pop culture that we haven't addressed, and I'm glad we left it off because we got to focus on it, video games. The Korean video game industry is in many ways dominant. Some of the most creative, most innovative video games coming out of that country. This is another sector of the industry that was intentionally developed. Explain how that happened and what the video game industry means to South Korea now.
Yes, well, this was one of the weirdest cases of making lemonade out of lemons that I can think of. After the Asian financial crisis, the unemployment rate was really, really bad, and people would go to the internet cafe all day to look for a job but also kind of goof off and play games. And people started paying attention to this shift and said, let's do something with this. let's make games. This looks like it's going to be very profitable even in and maybe especially in a time of economic crisis. So the government, again, reached in and financed the gaming industry. This is something that could never happen in the U.S. or, in fact, any capitalist country that I can think of. But in Korea, this is how they do things. The government steps in, they throw in money, and a gaming industry was born.
We do do it here, but what we do it with here is our military contractors, where the government largely finances basic research in health sciences too, but largely in the military. You raised the point in your book that Korea never had that advantage. I think your dad told you that, right?
Yes, my dad, who is a Korean economist, actually is the one who pointed out that because of a treaty between the U.S. and Korea, Korea cannot make any autonomous military decisions, so they can't wage war, and they're very, very limited in what they can develop. They're actually not supposed to develop nuclear technology at all, for example. So they don't have the advantages that every single other industrialized nation had, which was to develop technology as sort of picking up the leftovers from military research. So yeah.
Military applications that then trickle into the private economy.
Right, exactly.
GPS was developed as a military application, and now we all have it in our cars.
Right, and Korea never had that. They're developing technology for its own sake, which, as weird as it sounds, is revolutionary.
So what has that meant then for the video game industry, which started with direct government investment, something that probably wouldn't happen here in that way? We don't like that kind of government interference usually. What has that meant for where the video game industry is today?
Well, you think of K-pop as being a big business, but the Korean video game industry is 11 times more profitable than K-pop. And this addresses your earlier question of what are some things in the Korean wave that people aren't aware of. Video games would be at the top of that list. There's no cultural barriers. It's all in English, so there's no language barrier. And what they're doing that the U.S. and Japan have not done is Korea just ignored the whole console idea. They don't make an Xbox. They don't make a PlayStation. It's all 100% online games, which has meant that pretty much anyone can have access to it.
So what's your expectation then, given the explosion of K-pop, the 11 times larger video game industry, Korean dramas, what's your expectation for the next 10 years of Korean pop culture? This certainly isn't going to die down. But again, Americans don't necessarily like to get a lot of their pop culture from people they don't recognize. For us here in this country, what can we expect, do you think?
Well, this might be controversial, but the global economy is coming to the point where people are starting to realize they don't really need the American market very much anymore. It would be nice to have it, but Korea or any other country could really flourish by catering to the rest of the world and not penetrating America. And Korea is doing everything that America refuses to do, which is to say catering to the needs of the local culture and also selling to countries that are really poor and cannot even afford their products. American companies don't bother with countries that don't have money, but Korea invests in that because they know that 20 years down the line, those people will be able to buy smartphones.
You may be seeing the beginnings of a world that is leaving American pop culture and the American market behind. And Yuni Hong says that Korea is stepping in to fill the breach. Yuni, if it means that we're going to see an army of Thin White Duke, Ziggy Stardust clones on the streets of New York and across America, I might be okay with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be, actually.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, shoot 'em up, video games and pop music are not just fun and games in Korea. They're serious hard work. So we have a question for you before we leave you for the weekend. Who is the hardest working American you know? Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to nominate that person and tell us why. We're putting together a special program where we're going to feature your story. So again, nominate the hardest working American you know at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.